Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics.
Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net.
Hannah, thank you for waiting out the thunderstorm and flood we just had before you came over to do the podcast. Check out this evening's wine and see if you can connect to a film we are going to talk about, this Pinot Noir from Sonora County, California.
I can. It is called Lucky Star, and I looked around for something just like that because I figured the easiest find would be a wine to connect to Lucky Logan.
Logan Lucky?
Logan Lucky.
The title Logan, I don't understand Logan. Either.
Nobody, but it's a title that actually is going to detract from people seeing it, I think, because it does not stick with you. And I keep getting it mixed up, and it's coming on the heels of Logan. So,
and there's a movie coming out in a couple weeks called Lucky.
There you have it.
Logan so, Lucky.
In other words, we can expect this wine to make a reappearance in a few weeks.
We're going to talk about six films tonight, but Hannah and I each saw five. We split up on Wednesday. She went downtown, and I stayed up here in the North End and went to Silver Spring.
Yep.
Our first one is the biggest release of the week, the Hollywood blockbuster, The Hitman's Bodyguard. Hannah, Hitman's Bodyguard, hit me.
Hit me. Hit me with it. I liked it, I'm sure, way more than you did. I don't think that's a stretch. I don't think that's a... I think that for the very reasons that you are going to hate it are going to be the reasons that I kind of liked it.
Hate it?
I mean, not hate it, but to me it was just... It was entertaining. I liked it better than Atomic Blonde a few weeks ago, which I thought was way more brutal in the violence that was in it. This one was a little more of this weird action comedy crime hybrid type of thing going on. And, it stars Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson. And the two are actually quite fun to watch. And to me, if you had Deadpool, Ryan Reynolds, Deadpool, playing a bodyguard, there you have the Hitman's Bodyguard in a nutshell.
No, I didn't hate The Hitman's Bodyguard, but I certainly didn't like it. I liked Atomic Blonde, which you mentioned, a lot more. And it's the Reynolds-Jackson duo, and they're back and forth, and they're constant yelling and screaming and one-liners. It kind of just got under my skin and got on my nerves after a while. The only thing I think anybody's going to remember about The Hitman's Bodyguard is Selma Hayek. She's hysterical. She's Samuel L. Jackson's wife, and MF for this, and MF for that. And it's so un-Selma Hayek, but she's funny, and I think it's actually more violent than you said it was.
No, it's
a very violent film.
It's definitely violent, but so was Atomic Blonde. And so it's violent, but without the obvious brutality and the blood and gore that was in Atomic Blonde. In this one, even though there's a very high body count and very long gunfights, chase scenes, everything under the sun, it has comedic moments, so it takes you back into the one-liners and the zingers. And while you say you did that got under your skin, I wanted more of that. I actually wanted more of the sort of fun interaction, two guys that hate each other but are relying on each other to survive for 24 hours. I wanted to see more of their interactions and way shorter chases. And, the action stuff got a little too preposterous and created some really crazy plot holes. Like, how did they end up back in the same place after a 10-minute fight scene? So things like that kind of bothered me. But I agree, Salma Hayek definitely makes the most of what's a relatively small role. As even though she's basically incarcerated for most of the film, she is a force to be reckoned with, and they make that clear through flashbacks and things, just what makes her such a badass. And so it would have been nice. I can almost see in a future film being able to put Samuel L. Jackson and Selma Hayek together in some sort of fun action crime thriller type of film.
Man, you're absolutely right about those chase scenes. There are many of them, and they're really lengthy. We're talking downtown London, and they're shooting in London, the London countryside near Dover, and in the canals of Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. Samuel L. Jackson hops in a speedboat in the canals of Amsterdam. The bad guy is Gary Oldman. He is from Belarus. His name is Dukovic. He's on trial in The Hague. And you know what? That's the perfect country to be from in the former Soviet Union, Belarus, because they still have a dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, they're talking about Alexander Lukashenko. And it reminded me of his bad guy from Air Force One. Yeah, he just took the guy who took over the plane of Harrison Ford. Same guy, really.
It's very formulaic. I mean, without a doubt, for the most part. So I don't, you know, I wouldn't argue that, but there's a cute outtake at the end that you missed because you did not choose to stick around.
No, I was out of there.
But there is a cute little one for people who stick around for the end credits. There's just a little fun bonus outtake from the film that's kind of cool to see. But in essence, I mean, just for anyone who doesn't really know the premise, I mean, really what it is you have Ryan Reynolds, who's this sort of down on his luck former top bodyguard in the world who really had never lost a client, who ends up getting roped into protecting this notorious hitman played by Samuel L. Jackson, who going to be a star witness in the trial of Dukovic at The Hague. And so the idea is that Ryan Reynolds' character has to get Samuel Jackson's character to The Hague in one piece within the next 24 hours. Otherwise, Dukovic walks free.
Of course.
And so we've seen this before, you know, that, oh my God, the clock is ticking. Will they make it to The Hague in time? Or will this guy walk? And so there's nothing really too original about that. But it's, for the most part, if you were to, I say you could strip about 20 minutes from this film by just cutting down some of those gunfights and chase scenes. I suspect they are so long because they probably were in the budget. It's like, well, if we're going to be doing this, we need to maximize the impact and sort of make these scenes go on as long as we can because they're kind of cool. But to me, the heart of the movie is the interaction between these two guys who were basically mortal enemies up until they face a greater enemy and they have to sort of come together in order to help bring down the really, really, really bad guy.
The movie did indeed feel too long. It's directed by a man named Patrick Hughes. This is his second big feature film. His first one was The Expendables 3. So that's the level we're working on here. The Expendables 3 is kind of analogous to The Hitman's Bodyguard. It's really the same. And talk about a formulaic movie. It's just throw Schwarzenegger and Willis and all those and Stallone again a movie and
but they're
rinse
fun.
And repeat. And,
sure, but people like those. You know. I mean, those are entertaining. I was shocked when I looked at who this director was and you go, how in the world did he get to be the director of this particular movie
because
with that
cast? Because
the
budget was on fireballs and explosions, not the director.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm still surprised. It's still a really a strong cast to get for a movie with a relative unknown as the director. So, you know, kudos to him. And to me, I was sort of pulled in from the get-go because talk about your small world connections. I'm watching that opening scene in front of The Hague, and there's a gaggle of reporters, of international reporters, covering this trial. And I leaned over to the person, a friend of mine who was with me, and I went, oh, my God, isn't that Ralitza Vasilova? And she's like, I think maybe it was. And so we had to wait through to the end credits to see that one of the people in that gaggle was indeed a former CNN International anchor that we used to work with. So I then reached out to Ralitza. I said, hey, I saw your little cameo in The Hitman's Bodyguard. And so she thought that was very cool. So it was fun.
All critics are biased and subjective in what they bring into the theater with them. So I know why you like this movie so much. You saw your buddy in it.
I did. It's kind of cool. It's kind of cool. I hadn't talked to her in 25 years, and I reached out, and I said, I saw you, and found out that she's now working for, like, Bulgarian International Television. So so for that, it was kind of fun. But overall, I mean, still, if you stripped about 20 minutes from all those chase scenes and let punched up a little bit more of the humor with this natural chemistry that really I think was there with Ryan Reynolds and Samuel L. Jackson, then I think you would have had a much better movie. But in general, if you're just going to escape to the theater and like this genre, then it's I think it works.
Actually, I think if you're going to escape to the theater this weekend, I would rather you go to our next film, Logan Lucky, directed by Steven Soderbergh. Steven Soderbergh retired. In 2013, he released Side Effects, starring Jude Law and Rooney Mara, and he said, that's it, I'm done.
I love that movie, by the way.
It's a great movie. It's a hell of a twist at the end, if you've never seen that film. And then he ducked down for about 2 years, and he came back to Showtime, and he did 2 seasons of The Nick, starring Clive Owen. I only saw the first season. It's a fantastic series. And now he's back. He's unretired, and he directed a film called Logan Lucky. Talk about some heavy hitters. You were talking about heavy hitters' name. Talk about Channing Tatum.
Mm-hmm.
And for whatever reason, Katie Holmes and Adam Driver and Daniel Craig.
Yes.
So really heavy hitters.
A great ensemble.
This is about the South. It's about the American South, even though they're from West Virginia. But a lot of it takes place in Charlotte. And so the people from the South that are going to go see this movie, they know Steven Soderbergh from Magic Mike. The rest of us know Steven Soderbergh from 1989's Sex, Lies, and Videotape. 2000's Traffic.
Magic
remember
Mike.
Traffic?
Magic Mike.
The remake, Ocean's 11, 12, and 13.
I wouldn't even say those from the South. I think everybody really does know him very well from Magic Mike
Ocean's 11. Oh, that's terrible.
I think you're picking movies that
But Soderbergh has, I point that out because he must have, as a director, the most diverse filmography in Hollywood. He just doesn't, other than the remake he did of Ocean's 11, which was just not his material, it's so diverse, from Traffic to Magic Mike.
Yeah.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's a heist movie. It's a standard caper. You've seen it all before. They spend the entire movie planning and doing these actions you don't understand, but you'll know you'll get later in like an aha moment. Oh, that's where that fits in. Now I understand. So, it's about a robbery, but it's not. It's about the characters. And these characters, Hannah, I have a question. Are they laughing with them? Are they laughing with the South? Oh, that's so South. That's so funny. Beauty pageants and the drawl, the overdrawl. Or are they laughing at them? Are they laughing at the South? Which I have no problem with.
I would have said for the first hour and 40 minutes of this, but there's a twist that makes you kind of feel like, nope, who's got the last laugh here? And so I think in the end, you're kind of going, maybe these hillbillies aren't so, you know, quite as, dumb as some of them are portrayed to be. And so I do think there was a lot of talk that this was referred to, I think, as like Hillbilly Ocean's 11. And in fact, that really is what this is.
It's a very apt comparison.
This is a Hillbilly Ocean's 11. And so if you take that type of film and you transplant it into the South and into this world of NASCAR in Charlotte at the Atlanta Motor Speedway some of that and West Virginia and it's the Atlanta Motor Speedway.
It's Charlotte. They were in Charlotte.
Film.
I think they filmed
it in Atlanta. That's right. I think they shot some of it at the Atlanta Motor Speedway. But that whole dynamic and that whole underworld of NASCAR fans and stuff, I think it is playing a bit to them. I think I read that there were 6 cameos throughout that movie with NASCAR drivers.
Well, I know the announcers were just like Cars. Darrell Waltrip, Jeff Gordon showed up as an announcer. Adam Driver says cauliflower a couple times. When they go to the fair, they're not playing horseshoes. They're playing horseshoes with toilet bowl rings.
Yeah.
And the guy says, I know all about computers. I know all the Twitters. They are making
fun of them.
Which is fine because there are plenty of movies that make fun of Yankees and California hippies and Northwest coffee snobs. So you can make fun of the South. It's legal to do that. But he doesn't make fun of NASCAR. Because he knows better.
Right. No, and then so there is this part of it is designed to embrace. And Soderbergh is actually a native West Virginian. So he's not going to make fun of his home state.
Oh, hence all the talk about John Denver then.
Yes, exactly. And so this film, that's one of the most fun little tidbits is a John Denver song plays fairly prominently in that. And And so, yeah, it's, you know, that's why West Virginia, Mountain Mama, Take Me Home.
But allegedly John Denver never even been to that state.
But it is a, it is an anthem for the state. And so I enjoyed it. It's definitely quirky. It's a much smaller film than you're used to seeing from a Soderbergh, even though it's got these great, it has these very recognizable actors. Adam Driver just picks the most interesting, diverse, random roles you could possibly have in a year.
Isn't he great? I mean, he goes from Kylo Ren to Patterson to Silence Logan Lucky.
To Logan Lucky, where he plays this sort of one-armed, he'd lost the lower part of his, he's a bartender who's missing the lower part of one arm because he feels like his family is cursed, and he actually got his arm blown off while he was returning home from the war.
The script is so understated with him. Early on, Channing Tatum gets in a fight with Seth MacFarlane. Seth MacFarlane plays as just an annoying character.
Yeah.
And without saying anything, Adam Driver makes a Molotov cocktail and walks out in the parking lot and blows up the guy's truck. And it not a word is said. You just kind of watch him doing it in the background.
Yeah, and then you've got Daniel Craig in the most non-Bond role that you could possibly have him in, where he plays Joe Bang.
He's a peroxide blonde.
He's this peroxide blonde who's in prison for his crimes of like blowing safe cracking and blowing up safes and robbery. And the two brothers, played by Channing Tatum and Adam Driver, they're the ones who have kind of come up with the plan for this heist, and they need a Joe Bang to help them blow up a safe. And so Joe Bang, the story is that they break him out of prison long enough to help them with the heist. But he is such a crazy, bizarre character, and he's got these two Loco Yoko brothers who also are brought in to help with the heist. And those are the two that I think you're making fun of. This, like, those are the ones
definitely making fun of them.
Are making you make fun of everyone else? You kind of come to realize that there's different that their characters go a little deeper than what you initially would think.
And way the end, they launch a powerhouse Hilary Swank. Who takes over the end for about 10
weird.
Minutes, which is fine. You know, I like to see her every night. You don't see her a lot at all.
I know, but I found that distracting. I actually would have preferred there to be
She did it very well.
She did it fine. She did it well, but it was such a out-of-nowhere kind of role that it took me out of the moment because I was going, oh, my goodness, isn't that Hilary Swank?
What this sounds like to me is that we both liked Logan Lucky more than The Hitman's Bodyguard. You're laughing at it while you're talking about it.
I like them for different reasons. I love Channing Tatum, you know.
I know you do.
And so the whole Magic Mike thread. Soderbergh brought in Magic Mike. He brought in Riley, your good
Riley
buddy.
Keough.
Riley
Keough. She was in Magic Mike, too.
Was also in Magic Mike, exactly. So she's worked with him before. And as you pointed out before, she is Elvis Presley's granddaughter.
Yes, we learned a couple episodes ago. She's Elvis's granddaughter.
Since it's August and there's a lot of stuff going on around Elvis's birth and death and all that, it's worth pointing out that she does have a fun little role in this film too, as the sister of these two guys who are committing the heist. And she's sort of in on it as well. So it's fun, but I think they're very different. So The Hitman's Bodyguard, you have sort of this R-rated crime action movie, big action movie. Logan Lucky is a smaller feel comedy heist movie. And I think depending on just what your mood is, they're both equally good. So it's just whether or not... You're right. Logan Lucky's probably slightly better as a film and takes some different turns and is more, in terms of filmmaking and script and all of that, is the better movie.
And I would say not even slightly. It's clearly like head and shoulders above Hitman's Bodyguard.
Yeah. But it's certainly good. It's the PG-13 movie offering. And so I think it's a good choice if you're going with teenagers and stuff like that.
All right, for our next two films, we're going to split. I went to see Good Time, and Hannah went to see Patty Cakes. We'll start with Good Time. Good Times is co-directed by brothers Benny and Josh Safdie. This is their third film after Daddy Long Legs and Heaven Knows What. This is gritty. This is intense. I want to call it hostile filmmaking because it's so in your face and up front with you. It's filmed on film. You can tell. It is like this is from the 70s. You can feel it's gritty 35 millimeter film. And Robert Pattinson has completed his best work. You remember Team Edward, Twilight, Robert Pattinson. His ex-girlfriend, Kristen Stewart, has now launched herself as an auteur of late. The Clouds of Sils Maria, Personal Shopper. Now Robert Pattinson is given as good as her in Good Time. He is a petty criminal, and he's just not very good at it. They live in Queens, so this takes place in and around Queens, New York, over one day, one night. So it's like one of those 24-hour films. And Robert Pattinson's brother, he's slow. He's a mentally challenged guy who he needs the structure of a facility and therapy. And Robert Pattinson disagrees. He's like, I know what's best for my brother, and busts him out of the facility. And they immediately commit a bank robbery. Immediately. And, you know, they get it. They get the money. They're on the run. And they just screw it up because they're just screw-ups. And his brother gets thrown in jail. They catch him. Robert Pattinson gets away. And the rest of the film is Robert Pattinson. Connie is his name. They're probably short for Constantine. They're Greeks. Is trying to get his brother out of jail, out of the hospital, because he got beat up right when he got to jail. And it's just fascinating film. I gave this a 4-star. I fell in love with this film. It was the filmmaking is what it did. It was so hard to watch at points. I saw it with people we know, Tim Gordon, and he had a friend there who hated the movie so much. He was looking over at us, just waving his arms. What am I watching?
I think I would have been with him, huh?
And Jennifer Jason Leigh shows up as the girlfriend Robert Pattinson exploits. Barkhad Abdi shows up. Remember, he was the I'm the Captain Now and Captain Phillips. Right, right. He shows up as a security guard. I love the score. It's been by Daniel Lopatin is his name. He won an award at Cannes Film Festival, where this got a 6-minute standing ovation at Cannes. He did the Bling Ring music. I went back to listen to that to hear the guy again. It was shot by a man named Sean Price Williams. He shoots all of Alex Ross Perry's film, if you remember Listen Up Philip from a couple years ago. It reminded me of Run Lola Run. You get 10 minutes of just running and in-your-face action, and oh my god, my heart's gonna stop, and then, oh god, relief. Give me relief. And then another 10 minutes of action. He's a bad guy. Robert Pattinson's a bad guy. I'm not rooting for him, but I have to watch him and what he's doing to see if he can get away, and I don't want him to get away. I'm rooting for the cops. Like, collect this guy. He's going insane. Yeah, Good Time affected me, and I'm really glad I chose to see this film.
Well, and I think I chose the other one because I saw that it was going to be gritty, and a Run Lola Run did not really do it for me. I did not like that film all that much. I could just tell that it was not really necessarily the type of film I felt like seeing when I had to make a choice between Good Time and this film, Patty Cakes.
But you missed the performance.
So, and I that's the only reason I would have had any real interest was that, you know, I certainly have seen all the Twilight movies. I read the books. I know Robert Pattinson as everyone's favorite vampire, Edward. I was Team Edward.
Weren't we all?
Weren't we all? And so I absolutely am interested in seeing how he has evolved as an actor and see him in something different. So for that, yes, I'd be interested. But in terms of the tone of the film and that gritty nature and the plot, there was just very little in what I'd read about that synopsis that would have driven me to go see it. It's just not something that that appealed to me in terms of the story and just the way that it is shot. So the things you like about it, you know, are kind of the things that just don't really necessarily get my juices flowing.
No, I felt it was like it was a physical assault It was so loud. Oh my God, it was so loud. And the close-ups, I just wanted the guy, pull the camera back, get out from up his nose already, pull it back.
And I would have hated that.
He's assaulting me.
And I don't want to be assaulted.
Oh, man.
I do not want to be assaulted when I'm going to a movie. There are a couple of times where I allow myself to be assaulted for the greater good, like Detroit, but when there are those types of films that I make the exception for, those smaller ones that just kind of come through the theaters here that I know I'm just not going to enjoy, I'm more than happy to sometimes just miss them and say, oh, well, I'll either catch up to it if it becomes awards worthy come award season, or it's going to be just one of those ones that I just simply don't have the time or the inclination to go back and find. Patty Cake surprised me. So the one that I went to see was talked up quite a bit at Sundance. So it was a favorite there. And it's one of those films that becomes a crowd pleaser all of a sudden. It started the first half of it, I was not all that into it because I am not a aficionado of rap music. And I think it helps if you know your rap and
see,
you like
rap.
See,
I would have liked it.
Yeah. I think you would like this because the people who knew rap and who, you know, if you saw 8 Mile and Eminem and that, you know, that kind of thing, it's gritty, but not nearly as gritty as your type of film. This one really centers on this aspiring rapper. And her name's Patricia Dombrowski. She's kind of this heavy, blonde white chick who wants to be a rapper, and she's also known as Killa P and also Patty Cakes, and so those are, and but she's also known by the bullies in town as Dumbo, and so they're really cruel and they call her Dumbo. And here's this girl who I think she's supposed to be, I don't know, maybe like 20, 21. She's trying to find her way in the world. She is she kind of teams up with this guy who works at the local pharmacy who also likes to rap, and the two of them are this ragtag pair of aspiring rappers. And then they find this third guy out behind the cemetery one day with who's a very oddball kind of guy. And then the three of them sort of become this little rapping trio, but nobody will take them seriously. And she's got these dreams, and she is just dedicated to finding her voice and breaking through and somehow getting into that world. And it becomes this underdog story. And before you know it, even if you don't particularly like the music, you are absolutely rooting for her. And it's raw, and it's got some really some grittier moments to it, but it's also oftentimes very funny and infectious, and it's got some good beats. So if you are into the rap, the beats of the rap music,
I love how you say the rap music.
The rap music, hip hop. I sound like a white girl. It really is. It grew on me throughout this film, and I think it grew on a lot of other people in the theater too. You could almost see it happening, and it took some surprising turns. It seemed like we'd seen it all before, this type of path, the rags to riches kind of story. And in the end, they're in a competition, and you know, is she going to get discovered and just finally break through and achieve her dream? And There's some things that are predictable and then other things that are not. And in the end, you just feel satisfied with the film. You walk out and you're just like, wow, that was certainly different than I expected, but I think I liked it.
If Patty Cakes had a budget, would Killa P or Patty Cakes have been played by, say, Rebel Wilson?
Yes,
or a young Melissa McCarthy?
Yes. In fact, when I first, the very first scene, when I saw this Danielle McDonald is her name, who stars as Patty Cakes. When I first saw her, my immediate thought turned to Rebel Wilson in like Pitch Perfect, and that character and the singing and that
Fat
breakout,
Amy.
Fat Amy. And so there was definitely that parallel vibe of, if Fat Amy was an aspiring rapper, that's exactly who Killer P would likely be.
Do they take it seriously? Because at points, this sounds like it could easily become pop star, never stop, never stopping.
No, it is totally serious throughout the whole thing. So that's what, I think that's what makes it different. It's just, you don't really know what you're in for in the first half. And you're like, is this person serious about wanting to be a rapper? Is she talented? Are these lyrics any good? And I think anyone who knows their rap music would have probably recognized more than I did what the inherent talent there actually was for creating these lyrics on the spot and having like those rap offs where she could battle with someone else to really off the cuff come up with a really strong rap that is really about their lives in this gritty strip mall suburban New Jersey town. And so it is a grittier version of that underdog aspiring musician kind of film that we've seen before. It's
well, it can't be grittier different. Than 8 Mile. Nothing's no, grittier than 8
not
Mile.
Not grittier than that. It's not grittier than 8 Mile, but it's grittier than I'm trying to think of some of those films where it's just somebody then just breaks out and suddenly, you know, becomes this big star. It's grittier than like a Dreamgirls kind of thing. And I do think that it's a smaller film. It's harder to find, but if you really do, if you listen at all to hip hop and rap, then it's definitely going to appeal to you even more and is probably worth finding.
All right, our next film, I had no idea I actually kind of had a personal connection to. It's called Columbus, and it's not about the man. It's not about Columbus, Ohio. It's about a small town of like 40,000 people in the middle of nowhere, central Indiana, Columbus, Indiana. And I have no idea why, but half the town appears to be this mid-century modernist architecture that these famous masters went and built in Columbus, Indiana, and then left because everyone leaves Columbus, Indiana. That's where Mike Pence is from, by the way. Mm-hmm. So I spent like 5 months of my life up the road from Columbus, Indiana, getting ready to go to Afghanistan at this miserable army base. But I think I've been to Columbus. I just didn't notice the architecture. As anyone who doesn't know about, I don't know anything about architecture. I'm a novice. I don't know anything about buildings or what is modernism. I have no idea. So I didn't notice. And the people in the town don't notice, except for the people who are in the know and really form a bond with these buildings. And after a while of the camera just looking at these buildings and Haley Lou Richardson just talking about them to me, I grew to like them. And I grew to just like the slow camera and the slower dialogue just tell me about them, and I really got into the rhythm and the deliberate pace of this film. When I say Haley Lou Richardson, we've talked about her a number of times. First off, she was the friend on The Edge of 17, you know, a smaller role, but we took notice. Mm-hmm. And then she was one of the unfortunate ladies in Split. Yes. She didn't come out too well in that film. But now,
her acting was fine. Her character did not come out so well.
No, not most characters in that film did not. But here she is, front and center, in a small film called Columbus. And it's by a first-time director. His name's Kogonada. One word.
One word director.
And it's actually, it's not his name. It's a made-up name referencing one of Ozu's frequent screenwriters, Kogunada. So he combined it into Kogonada. Haley Richardson is 19-year-old high school graduate, but she didn't go to college, even though, you know, listen to her for 2 seconds, and this girl should be an English major, an architecture major at any, even Ivy League university. But she's a small-town librarian, and she stayed at home to stay with mom. Mom has made poor life choices in the past, and Haley Lou Richardson feels, I need to stay here and protect mom. John Cho breezes into town. He's in town because his father, a famous architect, a famous professor, has collapsed. He's in the hospital, unconscious, on a breathing tube. So, breezing in from Seoul, South Korea, John Cho is in. And this reminded me of Lost in Translation a little bit. They are different generations. John Cho looks like he's in his early 40s. She's 19. But they form a bond. They form a connection as they walk around town. And they just talk. They talk about life. They talk about architecture. She assumes he knows everything about architecture because your father is such and such. And he's like, you know what? If you grow up with it, it means nothing. But he challenges her. Don't tell me the facts about this building. Why do you like this building? And she challenges him. You know, why are you so cold to your father? Yeah. Don't you have any emotions? This movie, Hannah, it gave me the feels. I really, really connected with it. I really liked it. I'm going to guess you thought this was a little bit less than I did.
A little bit less, only because it was very slow. It's very slow.
We're looking for the word deliberate.
It's very slow and deliberate. It's deliberately slow, and you have to be okay with that and embrace it. I stayed with it.
Because it's gorgeous.
It got more interesting as you started understanding what they were trying to do. But it took a while to grasp what this movie was going for and the fact that it was trying to explore not only the emotions and the backstory a bit of these characters, but also the town itself. And it plays with shadows and light a lot. There's a lot of artistic direction going on. The light through the buildings, trying to appreciate why these particular buildings deserve to be looked at a little more closely than people who are just doing a traditional drive-by and wouldn't stop to think about the architecture. And so it was kind of cool as I got into it, but it still was a very slow, minimalist dialogue. Abstract, you know, you have Parker Posey is in this film as I wasn't even sure what exactly she was supposed to be. The professor's assistant. But then there's the implication that she was involved with the professor in some way, and that she might even have been involved with Jin in some way, who is the John Cho character. In very much the way you talk about how Robert Pattinson had this opportunity to really flex his acting muscles a bit and show a different side of him in whatever that Good Time movie was that you saw. In this one, I mean, this is John Cho. This is the guy that people have seen in Star Trek.
This is Harold and Kumar.
Harold and Kumar. So this is not your Harold. It's Harold. He plays Harold in Harold and Kumar, I think, right?
I don't remember.
I don't know. But anyway, so to see him in this very meditative type of role, and where a lot of the communication is done through looks and through the smoking and through bonding in other ways, and it's a very different movie, but it is most definitely an art house movie. It's an arty movie.
Yes, it's an art house movie, but I do not think this is nearly as slow as you think it was. You call this minimalist dialogue? This is sharp dialogue. It's on the point, and they're actually talking to one another. And it's refreshing to hear that when you hear Ryan Reynolds and Samuel Jackson screaming at each other these quick insults, and like, no, these people are having a conversation.
Well, certainly compared to something like Dunkirk, it's maximum dialogue. So, you know, it's all relative, but it is still, it's like one of those films that tries to portray raw honesty and complex relationships and emotions, but it is very deliberate. And so even your cat agrees with me on that, but it's, you know, you have to be able to, I think you need to watch this one really in a theater. If somebody tries to watch this and multitask, you're going to lose everything.
Have you ever multitasked during a film? Who's out there doing that?
Anyone who like
watch
gets
the movie.
Netflix. But I mean, that's a lot of times people are watching things, and this is one where you really need to be engaged with it from beginning to end.
I think anyone who actually chose to watch this film is not the type to multitask during a film.
And I do think anyone who's architecture students, anyone who really is into physical the exploration of physical spaces and light and design, they are going to really get even more out of this film than someone who doesn't have that extra appreciation. So there's definitely a segment of the population that art school people should definitely think about going to see this, because I think they would really enjoy it for the visuals. If anyone who's looking for a standard kind of story or traditional narrative, this one is not really going to give you that.
All right, we're going to disagree a little bit on this. But I love Rory Culkin, by the way, is the supporting character. He's a librarian.
And
I just really enjoyed him.
Yeah, he was good.
All right, earlier this week, Hannah, you sent me a link. And it's for a film called Dave Made a Maze. I'd never heard of it. I don't think I'll ever hear of it again. And all I have to say is, WTF, Anna, what did I watch?
I don't know. It was suggested to me by our dear friend and colleague, Nell Minow, who told...
A very famous lady.
Yes.
A movie mom.
She's movie mom. And she said to me, before another screening, she's like, oh, you should check out this Dave Made a Maze. I think you'd like it. And so I reached out and got the screening link. I thought, okay, if Nell thinks I might like it, I came to find out afterwards. She's like, well, yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's quirky. I did not know anything about it either. And I don't know what to make of it. You compared it to an art school project, and I totally get that. And it's hard to defend it because it is such an oddball movie. And it really is just this guy, Dave, is like some sort of aspiring artist who never can finish anything. And
that's code for unemployed.
Yeah, and he wants to create something. And so while his girlfriend is off on a business trip or something, he has built this maze in their living room. And it's out of cardboard boxes and things. And so she returns home and she hears Dave's voice from somewhere in the living room in these boxes. And she's like, what are you doing? And he's like, I'm lost. He gets lost in this maze of his own creation in the living room. And she's like, why don't you just cut yourself out? And he's like, I can't. And so it turns into this, it's like a horror movie. It's almost like a satire of a horror movie.
Because inside. If you build a maze, the Minotaur will show up and yes. He'll start killing people.
Yeah, I mean, and then it's so weird. It's a very weird film. But my favorite part, though, is that there's this aspect to it where there's a film crew or a TV crew that is shooting Dave's story and ends up following the girlfriend into the maze to go find Dave on this rescue operation. And then everybody who goes into the maze, ends up getting lost in this maze. But this crew is filming it like a reality show, and it's hysterical. And my favorite character is the guy who holds the boom mic the entire time and is just reacting. And I recognized from my experiences just, you worry about white balancing the camera and making sure you're getting your audio. And even if the camera guy might die, just make sure the tapes survive and that they're labeled properly with time code. And so that to me was funnier, but other people wouldn't find that necessarily as much of an additional humor element as I did. But I don't know what to make of this film.
Well, all right. So Dave Made a Maze is written and directed. First time writer, first time director, Bill Watterson. He's an actor, best known as backup musician number 2 in Jersey Boys. And he was on 2 episodes last year of The Young and the Restless as a prison guard. Dave Made a Maze won the Audience Award for Narrated Feature at Slam Dance. Slam Dance also takes place in Park City, Utah. It's for the really low-budget independent films, kind of what Sundance was supposed to be before it became Sundance. Mm-hmm. And Slam Dance is where Christopher Nolan was discovered and Lena Dunham was discovered, and the first Paranormal Activity debuted there before it became this monster franchise. So who knows? Bill Watterson could get discovered from this. And you mentioned the reality film crew. You like them. There's one thing I liked about Dave Made a Maze, and it's the set design. The cardboard of how they design the sets is really phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, the premise is so out there. I mean, this guy just, really, this maze is in his living room. But once you are inside the maze, it goes on and on and on forever. And there's people are getting killed and there's like confetti blood splattering everywhere. And it's just, it's very bizarre. But I do think that it reminded me of, one, the kind of projects that my college friends would have worked on. And that's about the budget that they would have had. Like, let's just build put these cardboard boxes together in somebody's living room, and then this is our set. And then I also, it was reminiscent a little bit of when we saw the two guys who did Brigsby Bear, and they talked about just this passion project, and we don't care if anyone sees it, if we get a lot of accolades
for it, they care.
But for them, it was like, we are doing this for ourselves, and we're making the movie that we want to make, and we think it's hysterical. I kind of got that sense from Dave Made a Maze that the people who were working on it, who were involved in it, were just like, man, this is so freaking awesome, even if nobody else gets it.
Brigsby Bear was way better than Dave Made a Maze.
Brigsby Bear is better, is definitely better. And this one is going to be a tough sell.
It's got to be just video on demand and maybe one theater in New York.
Yeah.
It is not playing here.
It's definitely limited in the number of theaters, and video on demand is probably where anyone who is inclined to find it will. It's not going to necessarily break through to the broader consciousness.
All right. To wrap this up, so when I thought Columbus was going to be the best film of the week, it turned out, because I saw it, the last film I saw was Good Time. It turns out the best film of the week is Good Time, just a little bit over Columbus. But since those are also limited release, if you're playing in your town out there, the best film that you can probably see is Logan Lucky, in my opinion.
And I say Logan Lucky and The Hitman's Bodyguard are probably the two preferred. Columbus is just, for me, too limited in its appeal I don't know. It's just not going to...
You know, I don't think too many mainstream people listen to this podcast. I don't think they would be into, it'll apply to me because I'm so mainstream.
But if I had to choose one that wasn't mainstream, I would actually go with Patty Cakes.
Yeah, I could see that.
And then Columbus at that point. Good Time, just because I haven't seen it, but it still really does not interest me.
You're going to get the screener because they're going to push him for actor.
Okay.
It's that kind of performance.
And so then I'll see it.
While you multitask.
And Dave Made a Maze, I will just chuckle once in a while when I look at a giant cardboard box and think back to this movie. And then in another week, I'll completely forget I ever saw it.
That's good. That's a good wrap up for that. I'll chuckle when I see a cardboard box. All right. On behalf of the Cinema Clash, I'm Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you.
Take care.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.